Welcome to the Playmaker Podcast, a podcast for people who want to sell different. Playmakers wage war against traditional sales and win. Remember, success is just one play away. Welcome to the Playmaker Podcast. You've got your host, Gabe Larson, here. Today we're going different. I know I say that every time, but today is somewhat different. I want to play a session for you that I worked on a little bit with someone who's become a friend of mine. Loved the talk track. We went over it a couple times, and I just thought he's got such great passion for his role, such a good overview of how he has been successful that I wanted to throw this out there to you. It's going to be called Go-to-Market Transformation, Building an Inside Sales Team from Zero to 330 Months. And it is Sid Kumar, and I'll introduce Sid here in just a minute, but I want to kind of give a brief intro before I do that. And I'm going to start here. Think about this. How many professional sales reps are there in the U.S.? 5.7 million, according to Inside Sales Labs. Now, according to our research, inside sales professionals, reps who typically only sell remotely, represent 47.2% of the 5.7 million. And outside sales professionals, reps who primarily sell face-to-face, represent 52.8%. Now, the global numbers will most likely continue towards equilibrium as companies report that the ideal split of inside and outside sales to be 50-50. It's about 49.4 for inside sales and 50.6 for outside sales. So, long story short, inside sales is not going away. And nobody knows that better than Sid Kumar from CA Technologies. Now, Sid was brought in a couple years ago to build the inside sales team from scratch, and he did just that. He went from zero to 300 and learned some incredible lessons. Sid, over to you.
Great to be here. Really great speakers throughout the morning, and hope to keep you awake for this session as well. What I want to do is take you on a journey that over the past 30 months, how we went from zero to 300 digital sales reps at CA Technologies. So I'll walk you through all the pains, all the gains along the way, but hopefully it's intriguing, and I'll be around for the next day or two, happy to answer questions along the way. Just a bit of perspective on my background, so you can get a sense of my perspective and why I'm making some of the comments I make. 15 plus years in the high-tech industry, pretty much my whole career. My background is a bit non-traditional for digital sales or inside sales. Started out in investment banking, tech, VC, and private equity, and then decided to make the shift to the operating side. And I joke around with our team that I've now been in every function except legal and HR within our company. So operating experience across a number of different areas. And right now I'm leading the development and execution of our next generation go-to-market strategy at CA. And that's really been the journey we've been on for the past 3.5-4 years. And I'll take you through that. But wanted to share that perspective with you. So I think first what I want to do is just give you a sense of the market dynamics that we play in, and then where CA exactly played into those market dynamics. And to do that, I want to use the example of Blockbuster and Netflix, which Vernon had used before. But this is one that I think is a great example of how the consumer life, you know, sort of starts bleeding itself into the enterprise. And this one, Blockbuster Netflix, was playing out over the past 10 years, and it was a really great example of digital disruption and how, if you're not looking, somebody else is doing something without you being aware and could completely take over an industry. And this one hit close home. You know, I remember growing up as a kid, going to Blockbuster on a Friday night, going to find the latest movie or video game, and it just became such an indispensable part of my life. And to see something go from, you know, indispensable to completely, you know, irrelevant in a matter of just years was pretty crazy. And it was really because if you look at Netflix, they paid attention to the user, they paid attention to the viewer, and they continually stayed on top of it and innovated to keep one-upping themselves. Whereas Blockbuster's executives on a regular basis denied that they were any sort of threat and thought they had it all figured out. And you look at it now, Netflix has over 100 million subscribers globally, and their market valuation is 25 times what Blockbuster was at its peak. So this was just a real example that was a bit of a kick and a real story that that resonated with me. And unfortunately, the story plays out across the Fortune 500. So if you look at it, over half of the Fortune 500 gone since 2000, and largely because they didn't see the signs of digital disruption and or they ignored them. And I think this was all happening at a time where CA, 40-year-old enterprise software company, was looking at it and saying, well, what's happening out there in the market? How do we get out ahead of this and help these Fortune 500 customers, a lot of them who are our clients today, how do we help them stay ahead of the curve and not get digitally disrupted by, another startup or another vendor? And that really was the catalyst for us going down our digital transformation journey in really two ways, which I'll talk to you about. The first was, it's all about, we really use this mantra of aligning to the buyer, and I know we talked a lot about that. And digital transformation for us was, how do we drive digital transformation and address the needs of our buyers? And that was shifting our actual product portfolio. So as I said, we're a 40-year-old enterprise software company. We've been around since the inception of IT, powering and running mainframes to client server to cloud, and the list keeps going on and on as we continue to evolve to different technologies. What we wanted to do was really get out from the ops side of the house to much more of the application side of the house, which we saw where the value was going, was in the application. Customers were engaging with their vendors through their application, and we wanted to help them go do that and drive a very compelling digital experience. So we coined this term, this concept around the modern software factory in what we call the application economy, and it rests on three pillars: agile, DevOps, and security. And it's about this being always on, sensing and responding to change quickly so that you're not blockbustered in your industry, right? So that was one. We really rebuilt the portfolio organically through acquisitions, looked at not just the actual capabilities, but form factor, big shift to subscription and SaaS as well. The second side of it was buyer preferences. So if we now give our customers software that is going to help them on their journey, how do we now engage with them in the way they want to learn about it and procure it from us? And this is where I'll spend most of the time, is really around how do we drive digital engagement with our customers so they can learn about what's on the top? And this was a complete retooling across marketing, across sales, in the context of driving that digital engagement. And I'm going to dive into the key pillars of that next. So from the go-to-market transformation perspective, really boils down to three key pillars. The first was mapping out and aligning to your buyer journey. And this was really, really important. If we were going to start down a path of any go-to-market strategy and we hadn't done this first, we would just be sort of shooting in the wind. So we spent a lot of time really looking at what our buyer journey looks like, which is going to look different from all of yours, what ours look like, and what are the different touch points and areas of interaction that we needed to have with them and when. So that sort of grounded it all, and I'll dive into each of these in a bit. Next was, what is the organization that is going to go power that digital buyer's journey? What's the go-to-market structure look like? And how do you make sure it's seamless from a standpoint of how the customer is interacting with your company? And then last execute across what I call our Rubik's Cube. And it's just a framework that I use to really prioritize the key areas and capabilities and where we are from a maturity standpoint on those capabilities. And I'll walk through that as well. So first, the buyer's journey. So if you look at the buyer's journey, and we've heard it all morning, the buyer's journey itself hasn't changed. Buyers still need to educate themselves. They still need to do research on different solutions and then ultimately select the vendor that they're going to go with. What has changed is how they want to go traverse that buyer's journey and the path they take, and what is the mix of interactions between digital and human across that buyer's journey. So one of the first things we did was we started with the digital interactions, and what we did was we looked across our whole portfolio. We have a, given our history, we have a wide and broad portfolio from acquisitions, from organic development, on-premise, SaaS, appliance-based, you name it. We have a number of different form factors, products that are in, you know, haven't crossed the chasm yet, and then products that are like mainframe, very mature, stable install base. So we don't have one buyer's journey. We had to go look at these different factors of where is it on the maturity curve, what's the form factor, and how does the customer for mainframe want to engage with us digitally? Very different than how the customer for Agile or DevOps might want to engage with us digitally. So we map this out working with our marketing organization, our product organization, say for each product that we wanted to really drive fast and hard, what does this look like from a digital touch point? We then overlaid marketing automation onto it, a plug for Marketo. We put Marketo into the engine to get this content distributed and tracked, and then really realigned the marketing organization around a focus on digital marketing. Events still play a big role, but you know, there's really been a shift to how do we create much more digitally and shift more of the resources and energy to be where the buyers are, which is digital. Okay, so next what we did was we said, okay, we understand the digital touch points. What do the human touch points need to look like and when? And again, this is overlaid again with the product portfolio and maturity. How we engage with a mainframe customer, which we do digitally today in many cases, is very different than a net new SaaS product into a new logo. So we looked at the where do the human interaction points need to be, and how do we maximize that in the context of their digital touch points? Again, not duplicating work or effort or intel that they already have from the digital touch points, but adding to it. So if it's a SaaS-based product that is trial-based, we want to be engaged early on to make sure they're getting value from that trial, they're maximizing the usage, et cetera. If it's a customer that already has owned our product for 15 years and they need to expand number of licenses, they don't really want to talk to us earlier in the cycle. It's like, give me a good price, let's move on. Let's sign the contract and move on. So that dramatically differed by solution as well. And where this sort of will touch into how we organized our digital sales organizations, we were organized by product because we realized that we have a broad portfolio that has different characteristics and needs to be treated differently. So we're organized, our primary axis is product and then geography. Okay, so now let's jump into go-to-market structure. So this is really where, so giving you the context, we now pivoted our portfolio. We're retooling the whole digital go-to-market engine. And this is about, I guess, 30 months ago. We said, okay, we need a digital sales organization to now capture all that demand and interact with customers when they want to do that. So fiscal year 15. So right now we're in our fiscal year 18. Our fiscal year ends in March. This entire organization that we call digital sales today was outsourced. It was not even digital sales. It was actually inbound lead management. It's a number of about a dozen firms from across the world that were doing inbound lead management, not aligned to any strategy, not clear who told them to do what they were doing, but they were lacking a strategy and direction. And over the past 10 years, we've had some form of somebody picking up the phone and doing something. It wasn't always part of a strategy. So this was right at the time when we had our new president of Global Field Ops and our head of sales came in and said, okay, the next 35 years have to look different because we're in a certain set of customers. We want to get to a broader set of customers and maximize our penetration in the ones we already have. We have to think very differently, and this needs to be core and part of the DNA. So key here is there was real top-down support, and he asked me to take this model and bring it in-house and drive incremental revenue. And that was really the beginning of this. So this is, I find out about this the Monday before Thanksgiving, 2015. And we had to be live by April with an org. So pretty crazy. And I, given my background, I didn't know anything about inside sales before I took this on. So I was doing a lot of Googling and a lot of listening to a lot of webinars. So fiscal year 16, we cut all of the first order of business was we cut all of these outsourcing companies out. We wanted to create hubs around the globe. So we have about 8 major hubs around the globe. And the first order of business was bringing them in, hiring people, and continuing the inbound motion because we were so used to the inbound motion. The team was very reactive, though, waiting for leads, and there simply wasn't enough leads. The engine wasn't firing enough to get everybody happy and busy all the time. So we had a lot of capacity that wasn't being used. So we shifted it to a heavy portion of outbound. And we were pretty scientific in the way we tried to approach that outbound, but the outbound allowed us to sort of tap into that latent capacity, but also allowed us to run some experiments on where could we take it a little bit further down the line. Because it was a tough year because it's still an overlay organization. And when you say you're building pipeline, people think it's interesting, but it's hard to produce a tangible ROI. I mean, we're showing all the metrics we could around pipe velocity, around new opportunities. But when you're thinking about a 40-year-old company thinking differently about a model that it hasn't had before, very, very difficult. So I spent a lot of time, evangelizing the merits of this and why it was going to make their lives easier. Since we were a complete overlay, their success is our success if we're looking at conversion rates. And really trying to get them focused on why this could be good and just to embrace it. And we did some experiments, as I said, where we could take it a little bit further. So we learned a lot. I think we, it was a very, very painful year on a number of fronts, but learned a lot and allowed us to, but we still couldn't show real ROI. That was the challenge here. We struggled with that. So when we go into the next fiscal year, we added about 50 heads, but not nearly going from zero to 150. We added about 50 heads, but the key thing is we added 2 new sales motions to this. Based on some of the quick experiments that we had run in the prior year, we found areas where we could drive the business end-to-end from a quota perspective. And we took our more mature markets, North America and Europe, and said, for some on-premise solutions, take the quota out of the field, give it to this team. Second thing we did is we were building our partner ecosystem along the same time. We said, let's create this digital partner account manager concept. And we aligned with a couple of our routes, resellers and global service providers. We also built out a digital pre-sales team. We found that a lot of the work like demos and trial support could really be offloaded to a digital team, doesn't need to be done by the field, which was spending a lot of their time on that. Okay, jump into this past year, which we're in, got up to about 300 heads. We now took the inside sales model, went worldwide with it on the primary quota side. And we went from not just on-premise solutions, but SaaS solutions as well. So 2 use cases we found were, mature solutions where we want to drive expansion, we can sell those. Or we could drive, if it's a earlier stage, try and buy type of solution, easy to do that as well. And then we expanded our partner coverage. This year was a really pivotal year for another reason. And the reason is that we actually created a separate segment that only digital sales and partners can play in that the field can't play in. Before, it was a bit murky still. It was a bit overlay. But we announced that we have a commercial segment that is exclusively owned by digital sales and partners, and an enterprise segment, which our field still plays in. We still play in that as well. And just about a couple of weeks ago, we took sort of one more step, is now realizing that this is really 2 orgs it's evolved into, a sales and a marketing org. We split it apart, and we took the sales organizations, which were at a sufficient level of maturity, and moved them into each of the regional general managers' purview. So they own it, just like they own their direct sales. So it's their budget now. It's not in incubation mode anymore. We took the demand generation side out, created a business development team out of it. I'm still leading that. Now I moved from sales to marketing. with the logic of bridging the connection. I'm working for the CMO to try to bridge the connection between sales and marketing and drive more velocity on this side, because we hadn't cracked that code yet. Okay. So now, with the building blocks in place, we kind of focused on the execution plan. So this is the concept I call like my like Rubik's Cube, because it's like you can pivot and change this however you want. What's in the boxes is probably going to be different for you on, you know, talent, processes, and systems, and where you are from a maturity level. But this was how I thought about, you know, our maturity along these different areas and how we were continuing to progress our model. I'll go through each of these. So talent, purposely start with talent, because if you don't get this right, the rest of it really doesn't matter. We thought about this in the context of hiring profile, competencies, and career progression, almost in that order, because it's in the context of, are you attracting the right people? Are you developing them? Are you retaining them? And hiring profile is one we spent, you know, a lot of time on, and I'll touch on that in one of my takeaways after this, so I'll pause on that. But competency model was really, you saw the number of roles we had, and it was not, we're an enterprise sales company with lots of roles, different geos with different maturity levels. We mapped out competencies for each of those roles and then mapped our reps to where they are and helped tackle the enablement. Marianne Kennedy, who sits here, runs our global enablement, been with me throughout this whole journey. Really spent a lot of time mapping roles to competencies to what the enablement needs to look like and threading that needle, which was a huge piece of work, but very important that it wasn't plain vanilla. And then career progression, given the demographic that we're, you know, largely talking about, millennial and later, re-architected the job structure and the job architecture so that there's more hops along the way, micro progression, I think they call it the term. So there's more hops along the way that are aligned to skill improvement, performance, and compensation increases as well. So one of my big takeaways here, I said, is on this the hiring profile. We spent a lot of time thinking about this, and you know, we talk about ideal customer profile a lot. We don't spend a lot of time talking about who's your ideal persona for your actual organization. We look at three things: experience, DNA, and cultural fit. When I came on board, we were hiring from college. Right out of college, and we stopped that practice because we looked at their ramp time, their productivity. In our model, which is a complex solution sale, or complex insight sale, really it wasn't working. We were training them on very basic things. We take 2 to 4 years of experience. We don't really care about industry. We care more about DNA. You know, passion. Do they have learning agility? Are they coachable? One of the best examples I have is a rep I hired about 5 years ago. Was running his dad's Jeep dealership. And I just had some of these attributes: passion, learning agility, coachability, and took a bet on him. And he's one of our, could barely spell IT, right? And he's one of our top producing sales directors now. He's gotten promoted, runs a whole team, huge quota, and just a good bet because it's around DNA. And then cultural fit, huge. We have a multi-step process for interviewing, and by the end of it, we can generally tell, is this person going to be a good cultural fit or not? So I'm going to speed through this. Next, on processes. First for us was lead management. This was a whole new vocabulary for us because we're an enterprise company built on, you know, ELAs, large deals. Concept of leads was sort of a new thing. So spent a lot of time really making sure the entire organization across sales and marketing understood what leads are, what are the SLAs, why are they important. That was sort of phase one. Phase two, as I said, was outbound prospecting. And doing this in a scientific manner as opposed to cold calling. And really thinking about now the ideal customer profile, looking at your high propensity buyers. We really tried to put more science around this, so we're guiding where the reps were spending their time. And then this last one on closed loop conversion. This is one that we've only recently gotten much more focused on. You could do all that, and if you don't get to closed loop conversion, it really doesn't matter if you can't show the ROI. So I'll dive into that. My takeaway here is on closed-loop conversion, it's about attacking the leakage, right? So we traditionally look at the sales process, marketing and sales process in a linear way, and I think we really need to be looking at it in a closed-loop manner. And if you look at it in a closed loop manner, the alignment between sales and marketing gets a lot better, but also the leakage points become much more apparent. And what we found is, you know, I mean, the leakage is always, it's between the handoff between the marketing process, the marketing funnel, and the sales process is one big area of leakage. And then wherever there's handoffs between two parties, whether it's BDR to a field rep or marketing to a BDR. And it's really important, I think, to establish that cadence and ongoing loop, closed loop discussion between sales and marketing with one version of data. This is one that really killed a lot of productivity when we had different sets of data and we were debating who had the right data. It was just an unproductive discussion. So we really tried to bring this together. And part of me moving into marketing was exactly for this logic, to try to bring this together even closer. Okay, I'm going to just lastly want to touch on systems. So you think of sales and marketing automations, or your CRM, your lead management system, as foundational. That's what we walked into. Then you get, we spent a lot of time on how do we drive the productivity of those two platforms in the context of what it does for our reps. So contacts, one of the biggest productivity drains that there is people, we saw it earlier in one of Matt's charts, like, you know, hunting for data or spending time on things that aren't calling customers and speaking to them. So we have an initiative around contact augmentation, contact hygiene, which is regularly responsible for looking at what accounts are we trying to get into, what personas do we need, how do we make sure that data is clean in the CRM system. Lead management, again, just putting in Marketo wasn't enough, right? We have to continually tweak our scoring algorithm, tweak how that was delivering and activating content with our buyers. So that's a continued work in progress, is how we make that a more efficient thing. But it's something we're continuing to get better in. And then last was really layering on the system of growth on top of that from a productivity standpoint. My takeaway on this last takeaway is really on simplifying your stack. There's so much out there. And honestly, until we got the talent and the process stuff right, or, you know, well enough along its way, I didn't even talk to vendors outside of our CRM system and our marketing automation system. That's really all we had, and we had to get the other stuff right. And over the past year, we've gone live with InsideSales.com and getting some great initial results. So really looking forward to the roadmap, how we could do more there. So the takeaway here is simplify the stack, because if you can't articulate to your rep why it's important to use that tool or platform, it's just a waste of time. You're just throwing good money away when you could be focused on something else. You don't need a lot. You just need the right things. Okay? All right. I'm going to wrap up with some takeaways here. So first, it's really all about aligning the model to your buyer. There's a lot of frameworks out there, but they don't know your buyer. So really think hard about that. And your buyer, you might have different buyers in your org if you're a portfolio company or you have more than one offering. So think about that and think about what the buyer's journey looks like across those different areas. So next one, show quick wins and build support for continued investment. This is one where you have to fail fast and be okay being wrong, and show that you are seeing it before somebody else sees that you're wrong, and repivot. That's how you get permission to keep going. Don't underestimate the importance of change management. So I have a really good operational team and sales leaders under me. I spent most of my time that freed up to go evangelize. And I had the top-down support from our CMO, from our president, but it doesn't trickle down quickly enough. They're reinforcement, but you have to go do the dirty work and make sure you're getting in region and really evangelizing why this is a good model to go embrace. Keep your model simple and keep iterating. The more complex it is, the harder it's going to be to pivot if you're wrong. So keep it simple, easy to understand. If you can't write it down on a single sheet of paper, it's probably too complex. And last, stay focused on business outcomes and ROI, because we're doing this for a reason. It's to lower cost of sale, drive revenue growth and productivity. If you're not doing that, then you're missing the boat. So thank you. Look forward to talking to you over the next couple of days.
Thank you, Sid. Now, guys, if you want to hear this session and other fantastic sessions, go to www.salesleadershipconference.com. One more time, that is www.salesleadershipconference.com. We're going to be having Sid as well as 30 plus other expert sales leaders all talking about growth. Kicks off April 18th. Check it out. And remember, success is just one play away.